This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Across the country, dogs have been reported as having symptoms of respiratory illnesses similar to what's known as kennel cough, but in many cases more severe and longer lasting. It's not clear yet if this is a new illness or a bad run of more familiar diseases. If you're a dog owner, you might have seen the headlines and thought, should I be worried? Our next guest researches how infectious diseases spread in dogs and other animals. She has advice for how to protect your dog from getting sick. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about what might be a new illness going around among dogs? Has your own dog come down with a respiratory illness this year? Do you have questions about prevention? And veterinarians love to hear what you are seeing out there. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jessica Pritchard is a clinical assistant professor of small animal internal medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Before we dig into the particulars, I'm kind of trying to figure out the right tone here. It looks like, you know, this is something serious, worth investigating more, but not cause for panic at this point for dog owners. Does that feel about right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that learning more about this and being cautious is a good first step for pet owners right now.
So what kind of reports are we getting from veterinarians around the country that might look a little different from what we'd see ordinarily at this time of the year?
Yeah, so what we're hearing about is that there are some dogs that are coming down with a cough, and that's not atypical for this time of the year for dogs. They get what you've described accurately as kennel cough, which is really a blanket term for a variety of bacterial and viral infections that can cause dogs to cough. Most dogs that get infected with one or more of these agents cough for a while, they feel bad, but they recover. Some dogs have always, unfortunately, been sick enough that they have passed away from this kind of spectrum of disease. What we're getting reports of now is that some dogs seem to be staying sicker and coughing longer. And it seems like some dogs are manifesting with the more severe form of this illness in terms of having actual pneumonia rather than just coughing.
How closely do we as a nation keep track of respiratory illnesses among dogs? Are we kind of relying on anecdotes? Is there some kind of monitoring system like there might be for some human diseases?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, we are kind of relying on anecdotes here. And that's one of the difficult things, is that there's not a clear case definition for these dogs. Dogs cough for many, many reasons, everything from actual infectious disease to heart disease to chronic inflammatory lung diseases, similar to bronchitis in humans. So all of those things can lead dogs to be really sick. Dogs can be really sick from heart disease and they can die from heart disease. They can be really sick from infectious diseases and they can die from those too. So it's hard to know which of these dogs has which manifestation of this disease without a national reporting system, which we just don't have in place.
So what kind of things do we do to try to figure out, okay, is this a new illness or maybe a new mutation of an older illness, or it's just kind of a statistically bad luck kind of year where the more severe but common ailments are hitting dogs in higher numbers?
Yeah, I think we have to kind of look at the data that we have so far, and that when we are evaluating things that have changed in the last few years. We went from COVID, where lots of people were isolating. And so our dogs do what we do, and they were isolating with us. It meant that also a lot of people were home alone, and so they adopted dogs. Pet ownership soared during the pandemic. So we now have more dogs around. We have dogs that maybe didn't get normal veterinary care because they were always home with their owners. And a lot of the vaccines for things that cause kennel cough, like Bordetella vaccines, parainfluenza vaccines, influenza vaccines, are given yearly. So we had disrupted veterinary care during the pandemic. It was hard to get our pets in, and it's still hard to get our pets into the veterinarian. And then now we're not isolating anymore, which is great. We can go back out and do the things we love with our dogs. So is this dog's being exposed again when they're underprotected for these common agents? And we've kind of lost some of that herd immunity that we might have had before. Or is it truly something new? And there are state diagnostic labs across the country that are collecting samples from dogs and trying to find out if this is a new pathogen. The issue with that is that we have such great tools now to really dig deep into the lungs and into the respiratory tract and say, wow, what are all the microbial agents that we can find here? And some of them just naturally live there, and we just haven't found them before because science hadn't advanced that far. So finding something new doesn't necessarily mean it's pathologic. It could just be something that we haven't found before and not the cause of what we're seeing.
Have you seen any data or at least heard any anecdotes from veterinarians here in Wisconsin? Are they seeing some of the kinds of cases that other people are reporting elsewhere in the country?
To my knowledge, we have not had an outbreak of cases in Wisconsin. I have talked to vets sporadically across the state because we do a lot of consulting at the School of Vet Med with our local veterinary community. And there have been some vets who have reported having even some of their own dogs that have coughed and seemed sicker than they typically would expect with your kind of run-of-the-mill exposure to kennel cough.
Talking to Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about some of the headlines you may have seen, maybe been concerned about if you're a dog owner, of what appear to be more severe than normal respiratory illnesses for dogs this time of year. Do you have questions and experience to share, thoughts or questions about precautions for dogs and their people? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jessica, I want to talk about the kinds of things that dog owners can do if they're concerned. First of all, you mentioned the common vaccines for dogs, and they may have been disrupted over the last few years. What kind of things should people be making sure that their dogs are up to date on?
Yeah, so there are some certain core vaccines that every dog should get. And one of those is distemper, which is a respiratory tract illness. So definitely making sure that your dog is up to date on their core vaccinations. But then those lifestyle vaccines, so those are things like Bordetella, parainfluenza, and canine influenza. Those are optional vaccines that are given yearly rather than every 3 years. So call and check in with your veterinarian if you're not sure if your dog is up to date. And especially if your dog is going to have exposure to other dogs, boosting their immunity by getting those vaccines is a great idea to do now.
And then when it comes to letting dogs mix and mingle with other dogs, it sounds like we're not at a point where we're saying, hey, keep dogs away from each other. Are there points, like if dogs are showing symptoms, though, where we might say, okay, no play dates this week?
Yeah, I think one of the advantages that we have facing this as pet owners is that we've done this for ourselves with COVID. So we know what to do when there's something infectious going around. We're all really well trained, and we just have to apply those same principles to our dog. So if your dog seems at all ill or not like themselves, they shouldn't be around other dogs. So no dog parks, no dog daycare, avoiding social doggy situations like dog training classes or dog shows. Definitely signs to watch for would be, you know, weakness. If they're not eating and they're normally a really good eater, if they have difficulty breathing, which would be a fairly obvious sign, but breathing kind of faster and harder, even if they're just kind of sitting around in the living room or on the couch with us, and a cough that's present at all, don't take them around other dogs. If that cough gets significantly worse or is influencing their quality of life, call to check in with your vet.
What kind of treatments are there if the dog is in that situation, that cough doesn't go away, seems to get worse, pneumonial, weakness? Are there things that we can do to help the dog?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't, similar to kind of the human cold, some of those are viral, some are bacterial. We often won't know what's afflicting the dog, if it's a viral cause to their cough or a bacterial cause. If we see evidence of pneumonia on x-rays of their chest, they'll often get antibiotics. But for a dog that's just coughing but still eating and doing okay, antibiotics probably aren't indicated and they'll be able to get better on their own. But the dogs that are sick will sometimes need to be hospitalized. They will sometimes need some support in the form of oxygen or intravenous fluids, and antibiotics given through an IV and then orally when they feel better.
We're talking to Dr. Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about respiratory illnesses for dogs, reports in some communities of worse than usual respiratory illness, something new, something old and acting a little different, still trying to figure that out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen these reports? Do you have concerns or questions about what's out there? Will you be boarding your pet over the holidays, or do they attend some kind of doggy daycare? Are you worried about them getting sick? What kind of precautions do you see there? Join in at 800-642-1234. Anybody who works in the veterinary profession out there, love to hear if things are looking normal where you are, or you have seen some unusual signs. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about how to protect our pets from the threat of a potentially new respiratory illness that's been reported in dogs around the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the warning signs for you? You can tell when your own dog is feeling off, maybe sick. What kind of things show up when you decide to take them to the vet? Do you get them vaccinated for diseases? What questions do you have about how to keep your dog healthy? And what questions do you have about what this illness could potentially be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kay is with us in Berlin. Kay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. I have a weighs 10 now. A mastiff, and earlier this year in the spring, he developed this awful cough, and he would cough so hard it was almost like he was trying to throw up. He was gagging so much on it. I gave it a week to see if it was something that would clear up. Took him to the vet. She didn't know exactly what was going on. He wasn't running a fever. He doesn't get around other animals, other dogs. And I'm always up to date on all of his vaccinations. So we took him and got a CAT scan done of his lungs and his chest and his heart. And it really didn't show anything. Everything looked pretty clear. So they put him on a prophylactic round of antibiotic just in case it might have been a really bad case of bronchitis. Mm-hmm. And it took him almost 3 months to get over this cough. It was awful.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm glad it ended up working out for the best. Thanks for sharing that. Jessica, I think dogs are like people in that way. A lot of different things can cause a cough, and it can take a lot to tease out what's causing any given cough.
Absolutely, and it's hard. You know, we have to rely on what we see and what we report as dog owners to our veterinarians, since they can't tell us, you know, hey, it feels like this, or it's worse when I do this. It's based on our reporting of how the dogs are feeling and then crossing those things off the list until we find what the cause is.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call. We've got Eli on the line in Burlington. Eli, hi.
Hi.
Or is that L? I'm sorry, I misread that last L. L, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I have a greyhound who has an intestinal worm that is hard to treat from Florida. And I'm wondering if she's more susceptible to this really bad kennel cough that's going around.
Oh, thanks a lot for the call. Jessica, could having some other condition, in this case, worms, make a dog more susceptible to other illnesses like kennel cough or whatever is going around now?
Yeah, those worms in greyhounds from Florida are really difficult to treat and get rid of. There are thoughts that dogs that are immunocompromised, so either they're sick from another disease or if they are undergoing chemotherapy or getting immunomodulatory drugs otherwise, might be at a higher risk for disease. So I think probably with dogs like that, it's safest to try and minimize their contact with other dogs right now and make sure that they're up to date on all of their vaccines.
Thanks for that call, Elle. And Jessica, it sounds like this is a known problem in the veterinary world, worms and greyhounds from Florida. What's going on?
It is. So there are dogs in Florida that, specifically greyhounds, that have a type of intestinal worm that is harder than what we typically see to eradicate, and take some pretty repeated courses or different drugs than we would often use. We're fortunate in Wisconsin that we don't have enough homeless dogs, so we import them from other states, which means as a veterinarian interested in infectious disease, I see a lot of diseases from all over the country that are not just geographically limited to Wisconsin.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that works out. Ruth is with us now in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yeah, our dog, who is 3.5, otherwise extremely, your dog, right? He's an extremely healthy dog, but I had put him in daycare for a couple days a week, not knowing that this cough was going around, and then I heard about it going around, but by then he was showing symptoms of the cough. And within an hour and a half, he was coughing so hard, he was coughing up blood, and took him in and got him in treatment like immediately with antibiotics and steroid, which helped, but it didn't eradicate the cough. The vet's being very aggressive with this. After his first round of antibiotics and steroid, he started coughing again. And so we took him in, he got 2 days of injections of antibiotics and steroid, and then back on the regular round of antibiotics and steroid. So it's definitely, when I talked to the vets, and we once took him into urgent care, and the urgent care vet said this issue is very much in our area, probably has been here for 2 months, if not longer. And they have lost otherwise healthy dogs, but mostly they're not losing them. The other thing we did, because of a recommendation by some very wise dog people, canine people, we put him on Manuka honey, he was up on Tuesday morning. He exhibited a cough again, even though he's on all these meds. Mm-hmm. And I have been giving him the Manuka honey now for 3 times a day. And the cough is subsided. I might hear a little bit of a huff, but no deep cough is coming from him.
Ruth, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Sorry you're going through that. A couple things there, Jessica. First of all, antibiotics, we'll try that. We don't know if this particular version of kennel cough is caused by a virus or a bacteria. If it's a virus, an antibiotic won't do much except maybe prevent a secondary bacterial infection. How much are we reaching for antibiotics when dogs exhibit these symptoms?
You're exactly right. So we try and make sure to limit inappropriate use of antibiotics and creating resistance to just be good stewards. And so we'll often look for signs of pneumonia on x-rays of the chest first. Things like a fever, a cough that's getting worse, will make us feel like we should reach for antibiotics in those dogs. So a dog that just, if an owner called and said, hey, my dog is coughing, but they're otherwise doing okay at home, my advice would be, watch them closely. As long as they're breathing fine, they're eating, drinking, doing their normal dog things, and coughing is not interfering with their otherwise quality of life, just keep watching them. But it's the dogs that stop eating. Like Ruth said, her dog was very, very sick, coughing up blood and really unwell. Those are the dogs that we are worried that even if they started with the virus, they've got a secondary bacterial infection now and need some antibiotics to help get them over the hump.
And she also mentioned, the vets saying they've seen a lot of this. Given that we don't, as you're saying earlier, we don't have a standard monitoring system, if veterinarians all of a sudden feel like, yeah, this is weird, we're seeing these unusual symptoms, like, who should they tell about that? Who should they raise at least a yellow flag to say, hey, something's out of ordinary here?
Yeah, the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is accepting samples that they're doing some extra testing on. So I would say, if vets, you know, call in and let the WVDL know that they think they're seeing this, they can get instructions on what samples to submit and how to submit them that we can test and see, you know, are we seeing this same thing in Wisconsin that they're seeing in the Northeast or in Oregon or in Canada right now? But it's hard to get that sort of coordination because also we, you know, people don't necessarily have insurance for their pets and they're, you know, someone has to pay for the testing that we do, which kind of puts owners in a difficult situation sometimes too.
Carl also mentioned using a particular kind of honey as a remedy. Now, I know there are probably, just like for people, a lot of alternative treatments out there. How can people make sure that they're doing something that is at least neutral, that an alternative treatment might not do more harm than good?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think talking with their veterinarian and making sure that there's no contraindication to their pet receiving that supplement or, you know, extra treatment that they've heard about through friends is a great idea. For most dogs, honey in small quantities is perfectly fine. But if you had a diabetic dog, for instance, that could really throw off their regulation.
We also had a question from Bob in Madison who wonders if there are pneumonia vaccines for dogs like there are for humans.
Yeah, great question. Right now, we don't have an analogous pneumonia vaccine in dogs. We just have kind of our core distemper vaccine and then Bordetella, parainfluenza, and influenza, although the influenza vaccine has been on back order in various places. So that one's a little difficult to get right now.
Thanks for the question, Bob. Jessica, just very briefly, what are you watching for next as we try to understand what's going on?
Yeah, I am really looking for, you know, veterinarians, I think, as a community, even though we lack kind of a central reporting mechanism, are very good at coordinating care and talking about what we're seeing. So I think, you know, watching for the state diagnostic labs across the country and up in Canada as well to see what they find from these dogs. And, you know, is it truly that we're seeing more dogs that are sicker, or have we, you know, not seen outbreaks of kennel cough in so many years? And so this seems like something new because we've been busy with other things for 3 years. So I think we'll learn a lot more as we keep talking about it. I think as pet owners, and I have two dogs myself, just remembering to be cautious, but not panic right now.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jessica Pritchard is a clinical assistant professor of small animal internal medicine at UW's School of Veterinary Medicine. She talked to us about respiratory illnesses among dogs, reports of the spread of worse than usual ones, and precautions we can take to keep pets safe. If you're looking to boost your memory, there might be an answer in Japanese food. As reported by CBS News, researchers in Japan did a double-blind study of wasabi. That's a green paste that has kind of a unique spiciness, like horseradish sauce. In the study, people took wasabi capsules and a control group didn't. After a few months of that, the wasabi group did better on verbal memory tests, face and name tests, and more. That's just one study, of course. More research to be done. I have a very distinct wasabi memory. One time I was eating Japanese food, dipped a bit of a roll into soy sauce with wasabi in it. When it hit my tongue, I felt the texture of a big glob of wasabi, and I knew I was doomed for the next 5-10 minutes. A couple seconds in, I felt the taste, then the famous whoosh through the sinuses, but a really concentrated dose of whoosh. Just thinking about that moment, I can almost feel it again. So maybe there is something to wasabi as a memory cure. But oh yeah, bad news. CBS reports that a lot of times that wasabi on the table at your restaurant, it's actually just horseradish sauce dyed green. Whoosh, there it is. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the problems of using body mass index as a standalone measure of health as the use of obesity drugs becomes more common. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a Wisconsin couple falling in love.
Though Steve and Emily Lakatis met in their 30s, they both found out it's near impossible to escape the awkwardness of a first date. And though it didn't go as well as they hoped, the one who set them up had the feeling that sometimes you just need a second chance. The couple talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Steve Lakatis, age 43.
And I'm Emily Lakatis. I'm 41. All right, well, you showed up and you just cleaned out your car. It looked very nice. And I looked at your eyes. You had a very long beard and very long hair at that time, and a ponytail at the back of your neck. But you had very kind-looking eyes. So I looked at you in the car, because we had never met each other. You picked me up, and that was the first time we met. And then you wanted to go to this Mexican restaurant in Hammond. What was it called again? That famous Mexican restaurant.
El Taco Real.
El Taco Real in Hammond, because you knew that from your childhood. So we went, and you had the worst stomach problems, and you wouldn't tell me what was wrong.
That's true. So I was like,
what is going on with this guy? And he was like, kept going to the bathroom, and he wouldn't tell me what was wrong. So it was kind of weird and bizarre. And to compensate, I just kept talking and talking and talking because I don't know, you were just being so weird. And so you thought you were not impressed because you thought I was just this crazy chatterbox. And I was not impressed because I was like, what is with this guy? So actually, we didn't really go on a second date for quite a long time. But then I was at the clinic. The clinic where you worked was my vet clinic for the rescue I ran, Happy Tales. And so I was there at the clinic, and just you happened to be bringing out some kittens to come to the front desk as I was there bringing an animal. And you kind of looked at me, and you were like, oh, hi. And I still to this day don't know if you came out there on purpose or if Mickey or somebody sent you out there. But when they saw that I was there.
I think Mickey sent me.
I think Mickey sent you. Okay, that's the first time you've ever admitted that.
She tricked me. I didn't know you were out there. She said she needed me to bring something up there, and then I ran into you.
Yeah. Wow, she is good.
Yeah.
So she was the one, Mickey, who set us up the first time, and then she created this second. Anyway, you kind of looked at me and you were like, oh, yeah, hey, like, I remember you. And you said something, oh, I'll give you a call or something like that. And you actually did, like, you started texting me again, which I was kind of shocked about. And I remember telling Mickey after our first date, I was like, Mickey, I wasn't impressed.
Yeah, I believe that.
And but then I don't know why we gave you a shot. So was the second date, was that the Gary Railcats game?
I think it was, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we went to the Gary Railcats game, and we started talking, and we were just having so much fun. We had good conversation. We both think we're quite clever, I think, is what it comes down to. And funny. So we went to the Railcats game, and we kind of hit it off. And then we officially, I think, started kind of dating.
So we married on June 16th of 2020. We're parents of two, one of which our daughter was just born about 4 weeks ago at this point.
We can't believe all the twists and turns that have led us to come to this place with these children. It's miraculous, and I think we're both just in awe of it and really grateful. And
you know, I love you more all the time.
I love you.
Thanks, I love you
Steve.
Too, Emily.
That was Steve and Emily Lakatis of Green Bay. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, body mass index, a measure of someone's weight to height ratio, has come under fire as an inaccurate measure of someone's overall health, especially if it's not used in conjunction with other factors like body fat percentage and more. Over the summer, the American Medical Association said that BMI should not be used as a standalone measure of health, saying the medical field has an over-reliance on BMI as a diagnostic tool. Now, with the rise of new obesity drugs, BMI is being used as a key part of the decision of whether to make that prescription. Our next guest dug into the story behind body mass index and medical care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever received medical advice or treatment based on your body mass index, your BMI? Do you think your BMI is a reflection of your overall health profile, or does it seem a little bit off base? Should it be taken into account when we receive medical care of various sorts? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yasmin Tayeg is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, BMI is kind of a household phrase nowadays. You dug into the history of it a lot. I didn't know about where this concept came from and how people intended and didn't intend for it to be used. Give us a little bit of the backstory behind body mass index.
Yeah, I mean, most of us know body mass index as, you know, at the very least, just as a sort of snapshot of our health. We have this idea that a high body mass index is bad and a low body mass index is good. But in reality, this thing came about like 200 years ago, and it was not meant to be used in that way at all. It started as something called the Quetelet Index, and it was named after this Belgian mathematician and astronomer who came up with a calculation to describe what he saw in data sets about European men. So this guy was looking at, you know, the heights and weights of average men and trying to come up with a way to, you know, quantify what a normal seeming weight was. And he came up with this equation. But the key here is that he was just trying to describe what he was already seeing. He was not trying to tell people what they should be aiming for. But over the years, that's how it came to be used. You know, at first, the insurance industry got its hands on this index and started creating these tables of weight and height to determine who was high risk and who was not. So they'd say, oh, you know, a person with X height and X weight would be considered high risk, and therefore, you know, we should factor that into our calculations for their insurance rates. Eventually, this concept of high risk versus low risk morphed into an ideal versus non-ideal weight. And eventually that transformed into what we conceive of as like an overweight or obese weight versus a normal weight. But there was a lot of transformation in there over the years where I think the true meaning of what this thing was supposed to be got totally lost.
What are some of the things that can throw off BMI as a measure? We have this ratio of weight to height, but there are a lot of factors, you write, that can say, well, wait a minute, this person at a lower BMI might be at a higher risk. This person at a higher BMI might be at a lower risk than we think just by looking at the numbers alone.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you said, the key thing to remember is that BMI only takes into account height and weight. But there are all sorts of other factors that go into somebody's health. So, you know, the reason I wanted to write the story is because my dad was talking to me about this. My dad is a very muscular person. He's like in his 60s. He plays a lot of basketball. And according to the BMI charts, he's overweight. But he maintains that he's quite healthy and just a muscular guy. And this is one of the issues that comes up. People who are very muscular tend to be heavier. For example, like LeBron James. And he would be considered overweight on the BMI scale when, you know, really, you look at this guy, he's not unhealthy, right? But on the flip side, something that some of the doctors told me is that you could actually have a normal BMI and actually be obese. So another thing that BMI doesn't account for is where is how much fat is on your body and where that fat is on the body. And so that's important because the positioning, the distribution of the fat on the body has some implications for your health. So for example, the sort of soft fat on your sides that you can pinch with your fingers, the fat that lives under your skin, that's not considered quite as risky for your health as what is known as visceral fat, which is the fat that lives deep in between your organs and tissues, and it kind of feels hard in your abdomen. that is associated with, you know, heart disease and other ailments. But BMI doesn't capture any of that because it doesn't look at fat content or distribution at all, which is what makes it all the more crazy that BMI is used to define obesity, which is a disease about fatness and adiposity.
Now, here's a new wrinkle. People may have heard a lot about this new generation of obesity treatments, kind of descended from diabetes treatments, the Ozempics and Wegovys, and the list keeps getting longer. And one of the diagnostic tools on if I prescribe this to you but not you is BMI. Why? How is this being used with this new class of weight loss drugs?
Absolutely. I mean, these weight loss drugs, well, I'll say that the experts I've spoken to have wanted to clarify they're obesity drugs. And this is important because, you know, they're meant to treat obesity, which is why their criteria for prescription are based on our definitions of obesity. And so the CDC, the World Health Organization, they use BMI to define who is obese. You know, a person who is with obesity has a BMI greater than or equal to 30. A person who is overweight has a BMI greater than or equal to 25. And so the prescription requirements for obesity drugs like Wegovy and now Zepbound are roughly based on this. So the rules are that you have to have a BMI of 30 and over, or a BMI of, I believe, 27 and over, with some sort of weight-related medical condition, like hypertension or diabetes, for example. And yeah, it's kind of funny to think that there's such a high demand for these drugs. And at the end of the day, one of the biggest criteria determining whether or not you're going to get them is if you have the right BMI.
Brianna, caller at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Sparta. Bob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I was just telling your receptionist there, whoever answers the phone there. Oh, back in 78, 79, when the Army first came out with the height weight program, and they were throwing people out of the Army because they didn't meet the standards, and that's all they went by was a straight up height weight. And I had a guy in my section, he was built like an upside down pyramid with the point on the bottom. And he was a wrestler and a bodybuilder, weightlifter. The guy didn't have an ounce of fat on him, but they kept harassing the death out of him, telling him he had to lose the weight. There was absolutely nothing to lose. He finally got tired of a mentor and he said, just put me out. And we lost a lot of good people back then when they first initially came out with that program.
Bob, interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Yasmin, a lot of decisions. The Army, it sounds like, some kinds of medical treatment. You mentioned insurance, even adoption. You give an example of one case. People are making a lot of big decisions about people based on that one number, the BMI.
Totally. It's become so baked into the way we think about health in this country. Well, not just in this country, but worldwide. And I think that's why the American Medical Association and the rest of, you know, the health world decided this year that, okay, it's time to really rethink this because this is getting a little out of hand.
Bob, thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Yasmin Tayag, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's talking to us about body mass index, BMI, as obesity drugs rise in popularity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has BMI made it harder for you to get health care of one sort or another? Have your concerns at the doctor's office you feel like ever been dismissed because of your body mass index? Do you work in some profession that uses BMI as a key statistic one way or another? Join the conversation with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Yasmin Tayag, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's talking to us about her recent reporting on the problems with using body mass index, BMI, as a standalone health measure. It's taken on new importance with a line of obesity drugs now on the market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried to get a prescription for one of these new obesity drugs that's out there? Was BMI a factor in whether or not it was prescribed to you? Have you ever taken measures aimed at changing that number, BMI? Not just losing weight, but saying, hey, I want to get to a target body mass index. If you are in healthcare, how do you use that number? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Yasmin, you mentioned that advisory from the American Medical Association saying, hey, let's not put so much weight, if you will, on BMI in doctors' visits. What are they recommending to people? How are they looking to use BMI in conjunction with other factors?
Yeah, you know, that American Medical Association policy change was a long time coming. And, you know, they basically told doctors, you know, we really encourage you not to use BMI alone as a snapshot of someone's health. If anything, they want doctors to use it alongside other metrics that will tell you about a person's health. So, you know, like we mentioned before, you could measure their fat, you could look at their blood sugar levels, you could look at their high blood pressure, you know, all of these, you know, various data points that together would provide a far more complete picture of a person's health than only their height and weight. And I think part of the push here is to prevent doctors from falling into the trap of judging a patient by solely their BMI. You know, unfortunately, we see some reports of that happening where a patient will come in, you know, get their height and weight measured, and, you know, the provider will take a look at their BMI and think, oh, you're overweight, and then go on to dismiss a lot of that person's other medical concerns. And so, you know, I think there's a general push to encourage doctors to look very carefully at the whole picture rather than this just one thing.
Let's go back to our callers. Jenny is with us in Dane County. Jenny, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to mention that when physicians use BMI for a Medicare wellness visit, that's a big indicator whether or not a person is high risk. So that can influence the reimbursement that medical facilities get, which I thought was an interesting point just to throw out there.
And it sounds like you work in a medical field, Jenny?
I do.
Yeah, and what do you think? I mean, do you feel like, okay, yeah, BMI is pretty good at valuing that risk, or do you think you wish there was a little more to it?
Well, there's a lot of factors that go into it, but BMI can be used to get higher reimbursement for Medicare annual wellness visits, which, you know, like you've been talking about, I don't think that BMI alone is a good indicator because there's so many other factors and it's all individual based. So I don't really care much for the BMI.
Gotcha. Jenny, thanks a lot for sharing that. I don't know, Yasmin, is there just something about, like, it's an easy statistic, it's one number that we could put on a scale as opposed to a lot of, you know, qualitative observations? Is that part of why we've relied on BMI so much?
Absolutely. You know, doctors will tell you it's not completely useless. BMI is best used as like a screening tool. And so, you know, you look at a person and it sort of puts them into a broad bucket of whether they might be high risk or not. But the idea is that you're supposed to go further than that screening and then do other assessments. But doctors will tell you that the reason that BMI has stuck around is because it's A, really easy to measure. You just take the height and weight, and B, really cheap and fast. Mm. And as you know, we know doctors are increasingly short on time to spend with their patients.
And we just have time for one more quick caller. I want to jump in, Yasmin.
Sure.
Teresa is with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Teresa?
Well, it's kind of what you're just talking about right now. Sometimes it can be, BMI can be used to prevent, you know, certain medical procedures. And I mean, I need a kidney transplant and the transplant team won't even speak to me until I reach a certain BMI. So I have to lose wait before I can even be considered for a transplant.
Teresa, thanks. I'm so sorry to hear about that, Yasmin. In just our last half a minute, there's a lot at stake here, life or death in some cases, in how we use BMI.
Yeah, absolutely. There really is. But fortunately, there seems to be a push among doctors, people who are making these decisions, to consider more. And there's also an effort to define obesity in a more specific way using like different markers from organs from the body systems. And so hopefully we will not always have to rely on such a vague metric.
Yasmin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Yasmin Tayegh, staff writer at The Atlantic. She talked to us about her recent reporting on the continued use of body mass index, or BMI, as a standalone health measure. The American Medical Association said this summer, doctors should stop relying on BMI so much. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the latest fusion research is raising hopes of commercial fusion power at an international climate conference, but is it really close to reality? A Wisconsin energy expert digs into the latest on the science of fusion. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a social relationships expert and psychologist joins us to talk about friendships and, when they're not going well, how to fix them or end them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.